Good afternoon. My name is Sylvie, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Kaiser CMS Emergency Preparedness Rule conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Nicolette Gleason, Interim Executive Director, you may begin your conference.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our webinar training on the CMS Emergency Preparedness Rule. We have heard from many of you as you prepare to get ready to comply with this rule, and we're excited to be able to provide yet another opportunity to talk more about the rule and some key considerations as you get started. We're thrilled to be able to have our partners. They've truly been fantastic partners throughout the past year or so, the Kidney Community Emergency Response Network, or KACER. And so please move to the next slide. And I know that Sally Gore is on the line and would like to welcome you all as we get started.
Absolutely. Thank you. I just want to reiterate what you said about being such a great partnership. Again, my name is Sally Gore. I'm the Executive Director for the Kidney Community Emergency Response Program, and we serve as a central point of coordination for the renal community during emergencies or disasters. So on behalf of the team at KACER, we are very pleased to be able to provide you with this educational opportunity in partnership with Healthcare Ready. Would you like for me to talk a little bit more about what KACER does?
That would be fantastic. Thank you.
Sure, no problem. As I mentioned, we do provide, this, we are a centralized point of communication for the renal community during disasters, and we do this by partnering with organizations such as Healthcare Ready, as well as ESRD networks, dialysis facilities, patients, federal partners such as CMS, and the CMS Emergency Preparedness and Organization Response Organization, and we make sure that patients have access to care during emergencies by coordinating with these partners and tracking facility operational status. That is just a high-level overview of what we do. I know that we'll be talking a little bit more about that as we move along. Would you all like me to talk a little bit more? Are you ready to proceed?
I think we're ready to proceed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Sally. So we're going to have three speakers. I'm really thrilled. It's always nice when you can do a webinar with people who are both colleagues and friends. So it's great to have both Bev Wittet, who is the Patient Services Director for KACER, as well as Craig Hamage, who is the Executive Director of the Near Southwest Preparedness Alliance, which is a great partner of ours and a fantastic healthcare coalition in Virginia. Just a quick word about each of them. Bev serves as the KACER Program Coordinator and Patient Services Director for the End-Stage Renal Disease Network 7. She's also the ESRD National Coordinating Center Clinical AIM Healthcare Associated Infection Lead. Bev is a fantastic resource because she has 18 years of ESRD quality improvement and nursing experience, and over 10 years as a clinical nurse manager in outpatient dialysis settings, so please consider her a resource. Craig is the Regional Healthcare Coordinator and Executive Director for the Near Southwest Preparedness Alliance, and in his role, he works really at the nexus of healthcare, the private sector healthcare business, local and state government, and public health industries to further the coalition model of disaster preparedness, and is a tremendous resource as you all begin to think about the various components of the rule that you need to comply with. Prior to his work in emergency management, Craig actually worked for 6 years in the private sector in healthcare services, and so he definitely, both from the subject matter expertise and the practitioner level, understand the concerns and needs of healthcare providers in both day-to-day and emergency settings. Next slide, please. So today we have a lot to cover in a little bit of time, but we're going to do our best to be as efficient as possible. If you have questions as we are going, there's a chat feature that I'd just like to point your attention to. Please feel free to use the chat feature to type any questions that you have to us at News Healthcare Ready, and we will log those questions and make sure that we address them at the end of the presentation. So I'm first going to quickly go through the objectives for today's webinar. And then I'm going to go through the various components of the rule. We're going to talk about the four key components and then provide some resources at the end for the compliance with the rule. So our objectives, we'd first like to make sure that you are very familiar with the requirements of the rule as well as the timeline, which is very important. This year seems to be going fast, so I think we're going to get to November pretty quickly. We'd like to make sure that you understand how to complete a risk assessment, understand the training and exercise requirements and the methods for demonstrating compliance, and then especially because of this particular audience and our relationship with CASER and the expertise we have on the phone, we'd like to make sure that we spend time reviewing considerations for ESRD patients and dialysis facilities. Next slide, please. So, Bev, would you be able to give a quick overview of CASER?
Sure. I think Sally did a super job giving just a high-level overview. I just want to encourage everyone to visit our website. It's right there, CASERCoalition.com. We support every aspect of emergency preparedness, all the way through looking at the hazard beforehand, all the way through mitigation and then response to the emergency. So anything that is going to impact dialysis patients from getting treatment, anything that affects the operations of the treatment, we're there to support. Not only the ESRD networks, and there are 18 networks across the United States, so depending on where your facility and your state is located or U.S. territory, you're going to fall into one of those 18 networks. So we definitely work hand in hand with them. We also have a patient learning and action network, a patient and family actually learning and action network. So we work very closely with patients to involve their voice in all the things that we do. We also provide lots and lots of resources and tools to help you with your emergency preparedness and management. And I also want to say how lucky we are to partner with Healthcare Ready and now Craig as well. We're building the coalitions and the communities that I think is really the actual intent of this CMS preparedness rule. So I just want to say welcome, add my welcome and my thanks to all of you for being on the call today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Bev. So just very quickly, we're going to just talk about Healthcare Ready. Some of us, some of you have worked with us quite a bit. Some of you have not heard of us before this webinar. So I just want to quickly describe a little bit about what we do and really how you should consider using us during events. We are in our 10th year of operation. Some of you might have worked with RX Response maybe in the last 10 years. So we actually changed our name about 3 years ago. And the reason is because we broadened our focus beyond just making sure that patients have access to medicines during emergencies to making sure that patients have access to health care. And in the last 10 years, we've responded to over 60 events at this point. And you can see from this slide that there have been a range of different types of events. We have responded to all hazards at this point. So if you ever have an emergency or an event of some sort in your state or your region that affects business operations and healthcare operations, please feel free to call on us. Our perspective is really to sit in the middle of the public and private sectors as a bridge in order to build community and healthcare resilience. And we do believe that it's critical in order to do that, that we make sure that the public and private sectors are intimately connected. So we do focus quite a bit on continuous healthcare delivery and supply chain operations, but we have activated truly in every state across the country. So we are more than happy to serve as a resource during events, and we're happy to answer any questions that may arise, share information, coordinate donations as necessary, and just help to ensure the facilities are up and running. So feel free to call on us during events, and I'm going to jump right into the rule now. Next slide. So first, we're just going to give a quick overview of the CMS Emergency Preparedness Rule. Just a little bit of history on the rule. The purpose is really to think about how to level set and really establish a national set of emergency preparedness requirements that would be consistent across provider and supplier types. And while the rule had been in research and then in development for a number of years, it was published last September. Some of us were really excited and actually stayed up and read all 600 pages. Part of the reason that we're doing webinars like this is so that you don't have to. The rule went into effect last November, and we expect to see interpretive guidance released sometime in the early summer at this point. But by November of this year, the rule must be implemented by the 17 provider types. Next slide. So there are four core elements of the rule, and we're going to touch on these during the presentation. We are first starting with the emergency plan, and then there are policies and procedures, the communications plan, and then training and exercise programs. It is important to note that all hazards must be considered as you are building your emergency plan and the related policies and procedures, but supply chains also do need to be considered. And so there includes issues that affect fiber facilities, and also thinking about natural disasters. And for us, as hurricane season is right around the corner, thinking about natural disaster preparedness and the ways that facilities need to prepare is especially important. There are special requirements I do want to note for patient populations. Next slide. Bev, can you talk a little bit about ESRD conditions for coverage?
Sure. The conditions for coverage for ESRD patients really mandate the care that's given to them as they are approved by Medicare. So these are the things that over the years have been required, and so I like to tell people that in a way this emergency preparedness rule is really bolstering what has already been there. We know you guys are doing a great job. We can tell nationwide that you take emergency preparedness and response very, very seriously, and so we feel like as you incorporate this rule going forward to November, you're going to see it's really bolstering and adding to what you're already doing. So you need to have regularly scheduled treatments. They're essential, of course, for your dialysis patients. And in the event of a natural or man-made disaster, immediate action must be taken to ensure prompt restoration of these treatments or to plan for the safe transfer of patients to alternate locations so that they can continue their treatments. Each facility must have a facility-specific disaster emergency plan and be able to respond according to that plan. And those plans should also address failure of basic systems such as power, source water, very important in dialysis, air conditioning or heating systems, as well as treatment-specific failures. Again, here comes water, such as the facility water treatment system or supply delivery. Okay, the mandated components of the rule. I think I'm going to turn this part over to Craig.
Yes, ma'am. Hello, everybody. My name is Craig Kamage. Appreciate Nicolette for the fantastic introduction and glad to be able to assist on this call. Before we dive right into the meat of this, I've got a couple sort of disclaimers. Number one, this call is being recorded, as has already been mentioned, and so there are spots through here where I'm going to go pretty quickly, and there are other spots where I'm going to go incredibly slowly. And the differences between those two are going to be to review and stress the points and the portions of these parts of the rule that I have found in my travels that are really perplexing a lot of different people. So in those areas, we're really going to slow things down and get into some specific terms and definitions, because in the emergency management world, words really matter. They all have definitions, and we're going to start with the definition of all hazards in just a second. Another disclaimer, I'm not going to review all the minutia details of the rule. I will turn you at the end. We have several slides that talk about resources, and probably the best compendium of resources for that type of information is the Asper Tracy website. You can Google Asper Tracy. It will be on a resource slide at the end of the call as well. They have several recorded webinars that go line by line through all the tiny details that are in the rule. Also, I'd like to encourage you to just read the rule itself. The section of the rule that pertains directly to dialysis centers is only 4 or 5 pages long. And so if we go through too quickly for you what, for example, needs to be in the communications plan, I would encourage you to just pull the rule out and take a look at the communications plan section, and it will tell you everything that needs to be included. With that, I think that we are going to get started I want to talk quickly about the definition of all hazards. Of course, the first part of the rule is that every facility must conduct an all hazards risk assessment and then write an emergency plan that is built in reference or in consideration of that risk assessment. And so let's start to unpack this and figure out what this means. First, I've seen a lot of confusion everywhere I go about what the definition of this all hazards mean. And I'm here to say today that all hazards does not mean that you need to have an emergency plan for every single hazard that could potentially happen on the face of the earth. You don't need to have a plan for fires and a plan for floods and a plan for... Now, you do need to have an emergency operations plan that is applicable to a broad spectrum of hazards. And so one way to think about this is if I have an emergency plan for my dialysis facility that I activate when I have a power outage, that power outage may be caused by a wind event, a thunderstorm, a tornado. It may be caused by a squirrel climbing up inside the transformer on the pole, electrocuting himself and thusly knocking out the power to your facility. All that to say, your emergency plan as it relates to a power outage event relates to all those hazards. And so I want you to keep that in mind as you develop these. Now, certainly, if you are a dialysis center in Florida, you want to have a significant portion of your emergency plan dedicated to hurricanes and other weather events that are common to your area. And your emergency plan should be prepared for all hazards. But the point of the all hazards model is to try to put together a comprehensive plan that where one plan covers what the facility would do under all hazard conditions. When you have a situation where you need to have more specific guidance for a very specific hazard, those are typically utilized in what's called an annex to the plan. In non-emergency management terms, they're often called appendices. You may have an emergency operations plan that covers the basics for what your facility will do for any manner of disasters. You may have an annex to your plan that covers very specific things that you would do in the event of a flood or very specific things that you would do in the event of a hurricane. And so it's important to understand what that all hazards means. And when we develop that emergency plan, it needs to be based on that all hazards risk assessment. Now, I mentioned that I won't spend all of our time talking about the tiny little details of the rule, and the reason is that I'm going to spend some of our time telling you exactly how to pull this off. And we've sort of moved, the rule's been out, and people have been traveling and talking about it for months and months, and now it's starting to get to the point where we talk about exactly how to do this. And so the all-hazards risk assessment, another term for that is what's called HVA, or hazards vulnerability analysis. And this is a method that you use to list the hazards that could potentially impact your facility, and then through some sort of systematic way, assess which of those you're most vulnerable to. And really, you're prioritizing those hazards to decide which of those you should focus the majority of your planning efforts on. As we get towards the end of our slide deck today, we'll have a resource there. That resource is also found on the Asper Tracy website that I mentioned prior, but it is called the Kaiser Permanente Hazard Vulnerability Analysis Tool. And I'll describe that tool briefly to you, and then I'll tell you exactly how to operate it. On the left side of that spreadsheet is a long list of hazards. And for each of those hazards, your emergency operations team in your facility may be made up of an administrator, a plant facilities operations director, some sort of a clinical lead, maybe some corporate folks. It might include folks from the locality as well and from neighboring facilities. But your team is going to evaluate each one of those hazards, and you're going to answer seven questions about each hazard. You're going to ask questions about what is the realistic probability that this hazard may occur at my facility. You're also going to ask, if this hazard were to occur, what would be the potential loss to human life? What would be the potential loss of property? And what would be the potential loss of business? So you're going to weigh those three potential losses against three questions about your preparedness thus far. One question is, what is my preparedness conversations about this hazard been to date? The next question is, and when I look at this hazard, how prepared are we currently to respond internally with resources we have on hand? And lastly, based on the hazard in question, how prepared am I to reach out into the community for external assistance to deal with this hazard? And so, again, I went through those quickly. If you go to Asper Tracy or Google directly for the Kaiser Permanente HVA tool, the instructions will walk you through that. For each of those hazards, you'll ask those seven questions. you will fill out the spreadsheet that's provided by Kaiser Permanente, and at the end, you will have a prioritized list of the hazards that could potentially affect your facility. That process takes 2 to 3 hours. You'll need to have all the right people in the room, so you'll need to put some thought into who might be on your emergency management team for your facility. But with the right people in the room and some deliberate questions, you can get an all-hazards risk assessment completed in an afternoon. You'll then go ahead and write your emergency plan. There are plenty of templates on Asper Tracy's website. There are other templates to be found. You probably already have an emergency operations plan in your facility. In some cases, it might be quite rudimentary. In other cases, it might be very robust. You'll want to make sure that your plan is very clearly referencing the top vulnerabilities that you uncovered during your risk assessment. And lastly, you want to make sure that you update your plan annually. I want to take and move your attention to the graphic that's on the screen, and I want to speak very briefly to sort of the spirit of this CMS rule. Emergency preparedness happens in a cycle. Okay, we assess and evaluate to find out what we're vulnerable to, and then we go ahead and plan for how we're going to react to those. Once we make our plans, we get together and we train on how to execute those plans. Then we exercise our plans. Then we look back and we judge ourselves, we learn lessons, and then we start all over again. And the CMS rule very clearly notes that all four sections of the plan, which, by the way, do line up directly with the four parts of the emergency management cycle, those four parts all have to be updated annually. It's not intended to all be updated in one awful week of your life throughout the year. It should be an ongoing process. Potentially you do an all-hazards risk assessment and an emergency plan update during quarter one. You do a look at your communications plan during quarter two. You brush up on your training and your training and exercises in quarter three, and then you make sure your policies and procedures reflect your emergency management program. So the spirit of the rule here is a comprehensive emergency management program, and I hope that when we get off the call today, you'll see that that's not too high of a bar to jump. So I'm through with this slide. Bev, is there anything specifically you want to mention for ESRDs in this case?
No, I think you've done a great job in looking at how you actually have to plan and be continuously looking at the plan, making sure, and a perfect example of how one plan can actually cover a lot of vulnerabilities. When you look at it, I thought that was perfect the way you spelled that out, especially with the squirrel, because believe it or not, I'm in Florida and that does happen. So, no, great job. Nothing yet.
very good. We can go to the next slide then. So policies and procedures. We can read through this very briefly. You need to develop and implement policies and procedures based on your emergency plan. So listen, if your emergency plan says that if we have a security breach in our facility, our emergency plan says everybody's going to do this, X, Y, Z, whatever those activities are, those things need to be written down in the policies and procedures. They can't just exist in an emergency plan that sits in a binder on a shelf somewhere and gets pulled out when survey comes and needs to check off that we've done this. Those things need to be converted over into policies and procedures based on whatever your organizational structure utilizes to make those things official. That's one way to think about it, is making things official. They gave a list in the rule of some things that your policies and procedures must include: evacuation and shelter in place, your ability to track staff and patients during an emergency. And so this is a capability. Let's say an emergency struck the community and you had to shelter in place in your facility, and then directly from there, your patients and staff were headed to various stopover points throughout the community before they could be finally reunited with their families. You need to have a method by which to track that. CMS tells you what you need to have. They don't tell you how you have to do it. So that could be a paper and pencil and a clipboard process. It could also be built into your EHR. You have to have policies and procedures about how to manage and handle medical documentation. Now listen, there's two sides to this. One side is to make sure that patient information is not spread all through the community in an inappropriate way. But maybe a bigger concern in disaster is to make sure that nobody loses their life because of an overinterpretation of the HIPAA law. And so you have to have the ability to share prudent and necessary patient information in a timely enough manner for continuity of care during a disaster. Your policies and procedures around medical documentation have to be just as focused on how we actually share this information as they are on how we keep this information private. You also have to have some information about the use of volunteers and some arrangements with other providers and suppliers. Again, there are even more to be considered, and one way to look at it is you've done a risk assessment, you've got your emergency operations plan. Let's take two things into consideration. Let's look at the mission-critical functions, what a dialysis center really does, an ESRD really does for its patients. Let's couple that with what we found to be our biggest vulnerabilities, and let's start there and make policies and procedures to make sure that we have those things covered. And again, once again, it's time to review and update these policies and procedures at least annually. Now, one more quick note on the policies and procedures. A question has been put forth to CMS enough times that it appeared as an answer in one of the frequently asked questions documents that you can find on the CMS Emergency Preparedness website. I want to say it's the fourth of those FAQ documents that had to do with is it truly necessary to make our emergency preparedness procedures actually become official policies and procedures, or can they just exist as guidelines? And CMS was pretty clear in saying that these need to become policies and procedures. So for what that's worth, they answered that question quite directly. Policies and procedures is what you need to meet the standard rather than just guidelines or suggestions. Next slide. When we get to the ESRD requirement, and Bev, I'm going to ask you to make sure I haven't missed anything specific in just a second, but the policies and procedures have to include, but here's the deal, they're not limited to things like fire, power, care-related emergencies, water supply interruption, we know how important water is, and natural disasters. But listen, this is include but is not limited to. For some reason, in the final text of the CMS rule, ESRD has these five things listed, and the verbiage says must include but is not limited to, and it lists these five things. And that's not listed, for example, for hospitals. And so it's a nuance worth noting in the actual verbiage of the rule. ESRDs actually list these five things. You can read into that however you'd like. But these five things should be included in your policies and procedures, as well as the other things that are essential to your mission-critical functions and the things that came up high on your hazard vulnerability analysis. And I already mentioned the necessity to track patients and staff during and after an emergency so that you can tell their whereabouts, if they're sheltered in your facility, if they've gone to a stopover point, and what their final determination was. Bev, I think that's the last I have for policies and procedures. Have you got anything specific to ESRD?
Just really quickly to point out, I know right off the top of my head why a couple of these things are on here. Generators are part of a lot of the other healthcare entities' requirements, and they are not in dialysis, so that's a big reason that power failures are on there. And water supply interruption, of course, for those of you, most of the people on the call today, I'm sure, are dialysis facility people, a lot of them anyway. Every dialysis facility has a mini city water room contained in the facility. It's critical. That water, although treated in a variety of ways, does go directly into the patient. So it's really a critical component, probably more than in some of a lot of healthcare entities. And the others, I would have to say, especially with fire equipment, typically a dialysis unit is standalone. You don't have the other staff that you have in the hospital setting or even in, say, an outpatient surgery center. There's limited staff, and there's usually, 12 to anywhere to 40 patients at a time. So all of these things become a little more critical when you don't have that other staff to call on in an emergency.
That's very insightful, and it's very possible, as you alluded to, that the rule itself and the verbiage used in that section was in some way relating to what the previous standard was. And so that seems to make sense regarding the power failures and the generator. So very good. Next slide, please. Your communications plan. You'll need to develop a communications plan, and the rule several times says that your communications plan or your policies and procedures or whatnot have to comply with both federal and state laws. You'll see that several times, and that's just to make sure that you don't perceive the CMS rule overruling whatever your local laws are. For example, there are localities in the country that will require dialysis facilities, hospitals, nursing homes, et cetera, to submit their emergency plans to the local emergency manager. The CMS rule does not require that. I think that in spirit, it certainly encourages that type of sharing, but doesn't require any facility to submit their plans to any local emergency managers. That said, several times in the rule you see this language about making sure that you are compliant with both federal and state laws, and that's just to ensure that nobody tries to hold the CMS rule up as a reason for breaking a federal or a state law. Your communications plan will have to be compliant in the same manner. You will need to be able to coordinate patient care within your facility and across healthcare providers, and you'll need to have contact information for staff, other entities providing services, other arrangements, patients, physicians, other hospitals, volunteers, contact info for regional or local emergency preparedness agencies, and again, this pops up one more time, your means to release patient information in case you had to leave your facility. So say evacuation happened during the course of normal business, you have to have a means to get your patient's information out of your facility so that it can be provided for continuity of care as the patient reaches their next disposition. And again, this will have to be updated and reviewed annually. I want you to read the rule closely. Dialysis ESRD facilities may or may not have this piece, but the rule, I believe, does talk about a redundant capability as well. And when we talk about communicating in a disaster, whether the rule contains it or not, let's get to the spirit of the CMS rule for a second. When we talk about disasters, we talk about what we're going to do when things are not operating under optimal conditions. And so I would encourage you, as you write your communications plan, if you start to notice that all the communication that you have in your facility is based on the telephone, start to ask yourself questions about what happens when the phone lines go down. What happens when the disaster happens nearby and all the cell phone signals are jammed and you don't have that method of communication anymore? Do you have the ability to utilize other platforms, whether they be text-based, whether they be heck, all the way down to amateur radio base. So I would encourage you to review the rule and ensure that the redundancy requirement is there. And even if it isn't, I would encourage you to think about what you're going to do when your standard communication plans don't work to protect your patients and to protect your business during a disaster. Bev, anything for this one?
Just a couple of things really quickly. Just to give an example, not even to go as deep as you did, although we do keep referring back to ham or amateur radio, so it's funny to me as we become more technology savvy or advanced, how we'll go back to that type of system. It's really interesting, but that is what happens when everything we're used to fails. But we recently had an incident, a dam failure in California, and I really have to give a lot of credit to the facility that was involved because they actually submitted an after-action report to us. Didn't ask for it. They just sat down amongst themselves and said, here's what happened. Here's what we could have done better, which is what emergency preparedness is all about, those lessons learned. And really, a lot of their gaps came down to not having their staff information updated. I mean, it was as simple as that. They did not have updated landlines if the person had them, or cell phone numbers, or addresses. They're a standalone facility, nothing kind of around them. There was no pre-planning for the event, where if it had been some type of, a storm that was coming, they may have gathered together and said, oh, let's make sure all of our contacts are up to date. They had not done that, and that was a simple gap that could have been fixed by really paying attention to these things and keeping up to date on those things. So, yeah.
That is, that's insightful, and I can tell you that if you read the after-action report of almost any disaster that's happened in the last 20 or 30 years in the United States, communication failure will be listed as a problem, as a lesson learned, and it's very often the number one. And so it's not unique to this industry, to ESRD, or even to healthcare, but communication is a serious challenge. I can also support what you've said about the amateur radio operators. I can say that every community that has a dialysis center, I'm certain, has an amateur radio operator enthusiast nearby. And they are a class of people that wants nothing more than to be able to help when things go wrong. So finding out who your local ham group is and connecting there and saying, hey, for $1,000, could you set us up with a rig that we could use to communicate? They will do all the labor for nothing, and they'll even show up at your facility when it goes bad to help you communicate. So can't prop those folks up enough. Let's go to the next slide. This is kind of where everybody wants to get some answers. And so the training and testing program, let's talk about training first. You've got to develop and maintain training and testing programs. Let's just use common sense for a minute. If your incident management team, your emergency management team comes together and does a risk assessment, They build an EOP, they write communications plans, they make all these policies and procedures, but you never train your staff on them. You've not really accomplished anything. Your staff need to be trained in a couple different ways. They've got to be trained in onboarding, so initial training on emergency preparedness policies and procedures, and then you have to provide this training annually. So that can be in a refresher status. I think that, again, the rule doesn't make this very, very clear. We might wait for some interpretive guidance on this. It does say that it needs to be done initially, and it needs to be done annually. Most often in emergency management circles, when that's happened, your initial training is going to be significant and substantial. Your refresher training on an annual basis will touch on training regarding your biggest vulnerabilities, your mission critical areas, and also any changes to the emergency management plan that happened over the last cycle. And so your refresher training likely won't be quite as in-depth on an annual basis as the training your employees receive at onboarding, but it is required, and you will need to be able to document that that's been done. The rule does not provide for how your staff will be tested about emergency procedures, but it does say very clearly that your staff must be able to demonstrate knowledge of the emergency procedures, and that's kind of where they leave it. So I don't know if we should read into that and say that a surveyor may ask a staff member what they would do in X event or what. That's a little bit vague, but that's the way the rule states it. They need to be able to demonstrate knowledge of the emergency procedures. We also need to conduct drills and exercises, and we're going to talk about that at length. Let's go on to the next slide. You must provide training, and one specific part for the ESRD requirement is the rule states almost verbatim that you must provide training and patient orientation on emergency preparedness to the staff. So in other words, the staff needs to be able to talk to the patients about what to do in the event of an emergency, what to do, where to go, including instructions for if there was an evacuation, who they should contact if an emergency occurs, and also how to disconnect themselves from the dialysis machine if an emergency occurs. So this is one nuance that hospitals don't have to deal with, nursing homes don't have to deal with, many of the other provider types don't have to deal with, this component of documenting that they have a standard process to inform patients of what the emergency procedures are, but it's in the writing, it's in black and white for ESRD. I think that it's just going to be part of your new patient process to inform them about what the emergency preparedness rules are for your facility. It shouldn't be a huge hurdle to jump, but it's worth noting because it's pretty specific for ESRD. And I'd like to spend a bit of time talking about these required exercises. So if we go to the next slide, we're going to spend a bit of time there. And this is one of the places where I'm really going to slow this down a bit because in the emergency management world, words matter. And I don't say that just to talk semantics, but words truly do matter. They have definitions similar to the way All Hazards has, a standard definition. And the idea that a facility must conduct a community-based full-scale exercise and one other exercise has perplexed a lot of folks that don't live in the emergency management world every day. And so I'd like to take a little bit of time to explain what those things mean. First, you have community-based as a definition. Community-based simply means that you don't conduct this task inside your facility and not let anybody else know what's going on. This is also, by the way, part of the requirement for the risk assessment. We didn't mention it specifically, but you have to have a facility-based risk assessment and as well as a community-based risk assessment. Now, that doesn't mean that you're going to conduct a risk assessment on the entire community. It does mean that you need to reach out to the emergency preparedness professionals in the community, whether it be at the municipality, whether it be at the healthcare coalition, whether it be at the hospital next door, and get a copy of their emergency preparedness all hazards risk assessments. Utilize those risk assessments as information and education when you build yours. That way your risk assessment is it's considerate of the entire community. It's a similar definition when we talk about the exercises. One of the spirits of the rule is to make sure that healthcare is interacting with the greater emergency preparedness community. This will include the fire and rescue department in your municipality or locality. This might include city government. It might include the emergency management department in your city. That might be a specific employee. In a very small town, it might be, you know, one person that wears three hats. It might also be the animal control officer. Who knows? It means that you're participating with the rest of the healthcare community. So you have hospitals involved in the exercise. You might have a nursing home involved in the exercise. You might have two or three other ESRD facilities involved in the exercise. That's what community-based means, as opposed to facility-based, which could be like a fire drill. It just, you just live inside your own little facility for that piece. Now, there are two more specific definitions that you need to know. One is full-scale exercise. Now, this definition largely came from FEMA, and this was released by CMS in a document that's hosted on their website called Definitions. And I've copied and pasted the specific definition there, but I want to draw your attention to the idea that this is a multi-agency, multi-jurisdictional, multi-discipline exercise involving functional, in other words, we're actually doing things, standing up emergency operation centers, et cetera, and boots on the ground response. In other words, we're actually moving patients. We're actually going through the motions and acting the way we would in a real event. As opposed to a tabletop exercise. A tabletop exercise is really as simple as your leadership team and in small facilities, maybe your whole facility, sitting around a conference table for 2 hours with a scenario that's been developed to test a portion of the emergency operations plan. It's a low consequence environment. Nobody's actually doing anything. We're just talking about what we would do if the event happened. Now, those two things have very specific definitions. Full-scale exercise is defined right there on the slide, and so is tabletop exercise. And so now let's look at the requirement. You have to conduct a community – we can go back to that last slide. You have to conduct a community-based full-scale exercise. Now, we're going to talk again about the spirit of the rule, and I'm going to take some steps to maybe be a little bit – to draw a few more inferences and be a little bit more confident than maybe what CMS has released so far. But if you think that you – I want you to not look for loopholes in this, okay? I think that the plan of sending one of my facility representatives to the full-scale exercise that's going on at the airport next week and having them participate in that exercise at the airport and trying to count that as me meeting that requirement, I think that's a bad way to go about it. The requirement seems to pretty clearly state that in order for this to count, you're going to need to – exercise a portion of your emergency management plan. You're going to end up standing up your emergency operations center. Very typically in healthcare, this is called an incident management team. And so this can be done in conjunction with exercises that are going on in the greater community. For example, if a hospital next door is conducting a huge exercise regarding a flood, and you decide that you're going to participate in the planning for that exercise, and you throw your hat in the ring and say, hey, we're going to undertake the same exercise. When this goes down at the hospital, we're gonna use the same scenario in our facility. We're going to stand up our incident management team. We're going to communicate with outside partners, and we're going to undertake the same activities we would undertake in a real flood. Now, you may not move real-life patients, but you may hire volunteers to you don't even have to hire volunteers. You may find volunteers to pretend to be patients such that you can move them into different areas if that's what's included in your plan. And then when the exercise time comes, you actually do. You fire up your incident management team. You execute your emergency operations plan. You participate in the exercise until index is called 1 hour later or 2 hours later. And then you sit back and you take a deep breath and you look at what we did and you try to learn some lessons from it. You'll learn a lot of lessons from an exercise like that. And so, again, don't think that you're going to meet this requirement by just sending a representative from your facility to participate in somebody else's exercise. That's not the point of this. The point is to exercise a portion of your emergency operations plan. You don't have to exercise the whole thing. In fact, we had a nursing facility. I know that we have a lot of ESRD on the call, but we had a nursing facility in my region conduct one of these just yesterday. The part of their emergency operations plan that they wanted to test was what happens if one of their residents goes missing. They invited all the stakeholders from the community, law enforcement and fire and rescue and the city and the county and everybody else. They are also adjacent to a VA hospital, so the VA hospital participated. And, in fact, the patient, the mock resident, was actually found on VA property. And so the collaboration between the federal VA hospital and the local nursing home was a significant thing to exercise. They exercised that specific part of their plan, real life, boots on the ground, actually looking around to try to find a real person, and they've completed this requirement now. As far as the tabletop exercise goes, the rule states that you have to do a full-scale exercise and another exercise. And the reason that it says that is that other exercise needs to be at least a tabletop. So if you complete a full-scale exercise, community-based, but you also have a real event where you have to stand up your incident management team, you've checked the box for the second exercise. It needs to be at least a tabletop, and in the emergency management world, that means it's going to be a tabletop exercise or a functional exercise or a full-scale exercise. A fire drill doesn't count. That's a drill, not an exercise. That said, they have given you some latitude such that if you have a real event, that could count as your full-scale exercise. Also, if you have a real event and you've already done your full-scale exercise, that can count as your other exercise for the requirement. I think that we've had several questions about the exercise requirement, and I won't try to guess any more of them. We've got just about 10 minutes left, so I think the very next slide, and then I'll turn this back over to Nicolette, but the next slide is about the interpretive guidance, and the biggest thing that's been said about the interpretive guidance so far is to not wake, and I'm going to back that up before I give the call back over to Nicolette. The rule here, if you keep in mind the spirit of the Emergency Preparedness Program and the intention behind having this rule, you can fill in the blanks that you find via a reading, and you can get 95% of this done with no additional interpretive guidance. And I can tell you that if you just take some of the advice that I gave you on this call, and the interpretive guidance comes out saying that I was just a little bit wrong, you will be 95% of the way there, because you've not read the rule looking for loopholes. You've read the rule looking for the spirit of a comprehensive emergency management program. So I encourage you, if you haven't already, get started, and I'll turn this back over to Nicolette.
Thanks, Craig. So as we've mentioned, and I think Craig has hit all the critical points, the interpretive guidance is not yet released, but really the rule answers a lot of the questions, and trainings like this provide provide a lot of information. So you really are 90% of the way there. We do have a listserv, just for your awareness, that is on our website. And as we get more information or when the guidance is released, we will be sure to share the details and the hyperlink for that through our website. We're just going to talk for a second about auditing and enforcement. There have been a lot of questions about how the rule is going to be audited, what the measures of compliance with the rule will be. And while it is not exactly clear yet what the auditing mechanisms will be, we know that, again, the idea is for us to make sure that because it is going to be a condition of the agreements with Medicare and Medicaid providers, the idea is for us to make sure that there are going to be multiple mechanisms for monitoring compliance, as is the case with other requirements for Medicare and Medicaid participation. We should expect that facilities who choose to work with local public health and emergency management to review the facilities plan will be able to meet the requirements, but again, not entirely clear yet what the exact mechanisms for auditing and monitoring enforcement will be. We do expect that it will be similar to other CMS-related rules, and so we think that it is reasonable to expect that there will be annual auditing and monitoring, but we will learn more as the interpretive guidance comes out. Next slide, please. So we just want to spend a little bit of time talking about what resources will be available as you all are looking to be compliant with the rule and just looking to do more in the emergency preparedness and response space. There are a number of resources that you should consider. One of them is Healthcare Coalitions, and I am going to make sure that Craig has a moment to talk about this as well, because his coalition is an example of one such that's doing some great work to be a great resource in their state. But coalitions really are a great source of expertise and preparedness, and they are a bit of a one-stop shop as it relates to coordination with your local community. And so they're going to be a great source of getting information around HVAs and risk assessments, but also being able to provide great templates for what existing plans and policies may be in place. And it is the hope that at a lot of the local levels, we're seeing that more folks are looking to lean on their coalitions to be able to coordinate some of these community-based training and exercise activities as well. So please consider your healthcare coalitions as a really key resource locally to work in community preparedness. Craig, do you want to highlight anything else?
No, you did a good job, and this isn't a commercial for my coalition. I can say that every one of you that's on this call, lives inside the boundaries of a healthcare coalition. You can find your coalition. I believe you can get to the link from the Asper Tracy website. You can also just Google, it's by name, by state healthcare coalitions, or if you just Google CMS healthcare coalitions, you'll find a long PDF which will give you some guidance. It's not perfect. Asper is in the process right now of sort of, a lot of coalitions are going to be redrawing boundaries in the next 12 months. You can also, in most cases, just reach out to your state health department emergency preparedness office. If you're in one of the larger cities, Chicago, New York, et cetera, you reach out to the city health department and their emergency preparedness department. Ask who to get in touch with. The healthcare coalitions want to talk to dialysis. It's just in a lot of ways they don't know how. And so so if you can make that outreach, they are a wealth of information.
And Nicolette, this is Bab, really quickly. CASER also has a state by state listing on their website. We are in the process of getting all of that information together, as well as making it easy for us to constantly and continually update it. So if anyone out there has any healthcare coalition information that they'd like to share, we'll be happy to put that on our website. But you can find a complete listing of all state healthcare coalitions.
Fantastic. Next slide, please. Craig, do you want to speak to these resources? I know you've mentioned the Kaiser Permanente tool earlier.
Just super quickly, you can pull out the rule and you can read it. What Dan Simpson and the folks did at the Tampa Bay Health Medical Preparedness Coalition is they actually they did that for you. They excerpted just the dialysis piece. Sometimes the rule itself is a big unwieldy document, and so they basically copied and pasted just the dialysis piece, highlighted a few things. I would encourage you to check out that resource in addition to the ones that I mentioned on Asper Tracy and whatnot. And then finally, the Kaiser Permanente tool, that's a bit of what it looks like. There's an instruction page there, and it's invaluable. It's one method. There's plenty of ways to skin a cat, but it's one method to accomplish that HVA requirement.
Thanks, Craig. Just a few more resources to consider. First, the CASER Coalition CMS page. It's a great resource to be able to see all of the federal resources in one place, consolidated, especially with an eye towards the need for providers that cater to the ESRD population. Healthcare Ready, as I mentioned, does have a knowledge center, CMS knowledge center on our website. And what we're trying to just do with that is to collate some of the recent and the most relevant and useful articles, as well as perspectives from healthcare coalitions. We will have recordings from various trainings that we've given and some of our partners have given. We will have a recording of this webinar on the CMS Knowledge Center as well. We do have a listserv to provide routine updates when there are some key movements on this particular issue. I think we've only sent out about 3 so far, so we're not in the business of spamming anyone, but we do want to make sure that you just have a pulse on what the key updates are. Also, be mindful that federal and accrediting organizations like the Joint Commission and FEMA's Emergency Management Institute have some really key resources as well on their websites. The Joint Commission has a fantastic emergency management portal that also has great information as well. And FEMA's EMI does offer a number of online courses that will be useful as you begin to prepare to comply. I do also want to mention that the original rule, as well as a number of aggregated resources, are on the CMS website. And our partners at HHS Asper, the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, their team, Tracy, has done a fantastic job of building their website to really be able to provide practical resources and serve as a great hub of best practices and great templates and other information that you can really pull to just get right off of their portal and be able to use right away to help you as you begin to comply. And so there are a number of resources, and they have dedicated a whole section to the CMS Emergency Preparedness Rule. And they have a number of resources that are on there, including their constantly updated CMS resources at your fingertips. And really, the genesis of the Tracy site was to be able to provide a single place within the HHS system to be able to give great technical assistance and to allow for information exchange to happen not just with the federal government, but across healthcare. And so it's a great place to go to be able to get that information and to have that communication and to be able to pull those resources or ask questions and get insight from other folks. So with that, our formal presentation is done, and I know we've gotten a few questions via chat, but we are going to be looking at the chat feature to get questions, and we're going to open the line for questions as well.
Hey, Nicolette.
Yes.
This is Craig. I got one question here in the chat that I think a lot of people might have. Can I address that one right off the bat?
Certainly.
So a person chatted me privately and asked a question that I think might relate to a lot of dialysis facilities, and if it doesn't relate directly to yours, it's still a key emergency management concept that I think y'all will appreciate. The question is that this dialysis unit is a department of a hospital. They have a very structured emergency management plan. The facility follows all the hospital's policies and procedures, and the asker would like to know if they can use the hospital's plan but add a dialysis section. The unit's not in the hospital, but it's on the grounds. And so listen, a couple things. Number one, the CMS rule does provide for what is called an integrated healthcare system or an integrated facility. It provides for a hospital that also includes a dialysis center as part of the hospital. I think that you're going to need that. That is a part of the rule that you'll want to read very carefully. You may actually even reach out to Asper Tracy. I don't want to wade into what certifications would provide success or failure on that part of qualifying as integrated. Read it carefully yourself and make that decision. They did answer that question on the one of the last MLN calls that's recorded on the Asper Tracy website. I will admit that I was a little confused by the answer. That was probably just me. So I would encourage you to listen to that. I'd encourage you to reach out if you have a question. That said, there is a mechanism for if the hospital is interested in setting their emergency operations plan up in that manner for you to participate with them in that way. And depending again on whether you have separate certification with CMS or not, depending on what your specific relationship is to the hospital. So I would encourage you to look into that. However, this person also uncovers another significant thing about emergency management. And that is nobody has written their own emergency operations plan, I don't think, since Moses carved the stone tablet. We always steal plans from everybody else. That's just what we do. And so the main question, could I take the hospital's plan and add a dialysis section? Well, it might not be that simple, but could you take the hospital's plan, pull out the parts that don't apply to dialysis, build in the parts that do apply to dialysis, and then have a very comprehensive dialysis plan? I think that there's potential there, especially if when you do that, you give consideration to your all-hazards risk assessment and you ensure that your training and exercising is based on the plan that really is specific for your facility. And so that's just a key. I mean, it sounds like a shortcut. It's not a shortcut. That's how plans improve over time. No emergency manager sits down with a blank sheet of paper and starts to write a plan. We always grab a plan from a similar place and try to adapt it and improve on it. That's how incremental improvement in the emergency management industry works. And so when we talked about writing your emergency operations plan, if for some reason you don't have one at all, find a similar facility and look to cooperate with them. It's not a copy and paste. It's a let's use that. We just got another question in the chat. Is there a communication plan template? There are some templates on Asper Tracy. The rule itself gives a pretty clear explanation of what you should be in your communications plan. But I would also reach out to a Joint Commission accredited hospital facility and ask them to see their communications plan. And that's going to give you basically a template that you can use. If you can include the things that are included in there, the things that are included in the rule, you're not asked to reinvent the wheel here. You just need the final product. Now, we want to make sure that we're keeping the spirit in mind. We're not trying to take shortcuts here. But that's just how plans get written and how plans get adapted and how plans get improved. So I would encourage y'all to do that.
Thanks, Craig. Are there any other questions on the line, operator?
And if you would like to ask a question, let me remind you that it is star followed by one on your telephone keypad. At the moment, we do not have any questions.
There's one more question on the chat. Can you see that question? And Bev, I don't know the answer to it at all. The question is, can you recommend resources or guidance for an independent peritoneal dialysis clinic where dialysis is done in the patient home only? That one
yes.
has me swing.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. You actually did a great job by talking about the adaptation of existing communication and emergency plans. This person, Deborah, you can reach out directly to me at CASER and I can help you a little more individually. But what Craig was talking about is using something that is existing, and there's lots of resources on, you can get them on CASER, on AsperTracy, on Healthcare Ready. You're going to have to look and see what is important to your patients and your staff when these emergencies happen, and everything you know as real right now is gone. That's exactly what Craig was explaining. It doesn't mean you can't take what's out there and change it and alter it so that it fits your clinic and your patients. What are you going to need when communication is down? What are you going to need when some of your staff is down? Are you able to get staff to help these patients? How often do you have to help them? Do you have plans in place that you know where your patients might be going if they have to evacuate? As long as you're hitting all those strides, you're hitting all those notes, that when this disaster happens, you've got a plan in place to cover that. You know where your patients are or you know where they're going, you'll be okay. But please feel free to reach out to me directly. I did mention in the private chat, I'll go ahead and take care of it since I did get just another second to speak. My email address is actually bwitted@hsag.com, not .org. And that's one way to reach me. Or go through the CASER website. There's a way to contact CASER staff that way as well. We'll be glad to help you with that.
I think, not to belabor the topic, but I may just add one more comment to the idea of adapting the plans of others. And that's, let's use an example. If a dialysis facility, ESRD facility, were to take a hospital plan, of course, you'll eliminate any hospital emergency management plan worth anything is going to have a whole section in there, for example, about the nuclear magnetic resonance, the MRI unit, and the procedures that need to be done with that and a power failure and whatever else. If you don't have an MRI in your facility, you need to take that section out. If the surveyor comes on in to look at your emergency operations plan and you still have a giant section in there about an MRI machine that you don't have, it's going to be clear that you were looking to cut corners when you adapted that plan. Similarly, you'll have to make additions for dialysis. A dialysis center is going to want to have in their communications plan the ability to reach out to a hospital. Well, that's not going to already exist in the hospital's plan because they're not going to reach out to themselves. Similarly, it sounds like ESRD facilities are much more reliant upon potable water or even at a higher standard of water for your mission critical functions than a hospital. I can tell you a lot of hospitals can go for a long time with a water interruption, a long time being, 24 or 48 hours. And so your plan really needs to be adapted to meet your facility. I want to stress that again, not trying to belabor the topic, but I don't want you guys to think that I'm saying to cut corners. I'm just saying that's common to how the industry operates. So with that, I think that's about all I have, unless there are more questions, Nicolette.
Operator, are there any questions on the line?
Yes, there are. Your next question comes from the line of Lynn Nguyen. Your line is open.
Yeah, I have a quick question. In the past, when I tried to call the local emergency, because in our policy say we have to contact, but when I called them, they said, what do you want me to do? So I just don't know how to answer that question.
Okay, cool. Good question. The question I'll repeat, and that is that this person mentioned that they have reached out in the past to the local emergency manager and gotten kind of a dumbfounded response. What do you want me to do? And it's important very quickly to understand what the emergency manager does. The emergency manager doesn't do emergency response. The emergency manager does planning and coordination. So you can't reach out to the emergency manager when you need something immediately. That doesn't work. If the building's on fire, you call 911. If you need something done immediately, that's not when you reach out to them. The emergency manager functions in a planning component, and during a response, if a big disaster happens, they function to coordinate communication and information of the first responders, of the boots on the ground type people. And so the rule provides a solution to the specific problem mentioned in that the ESRD facility needs to document that outreach was done. CMS cannot mandate anything. They can't mandate the emergency manager to do anything. They don't have jurisdiction over the emergency manager. That's typically a local government job. That said, if you can document that you did that outreach, then that type of outreach is going to be covered. The rule has stated as long as you document that you attempted that outreach. However, I'll go one step further and say that figuring out how to make good contact with the emergency management can pay big dividends down the road. And if you have a dud as an emergency manager in your town, you're just unlucky enough to have sort of a bump on the log emergency manager, start asking people around them. Ask the fire chief, ask the head of the EMS council, find somebody that can get you some assistance in your planning efforts. So the three things there, like I said, or to recap that, understand that the emergency manager doesn't do emergency response. They only exist in planning and coordination. And if you have trouble just because that individual is tough to deal with or manage, and you've tried that several times, feel free to reach out to the folks around them. I will say that, and in fact, if you're reaching out to a local emergency manager, you will likely also have a state department of emergency management. And whereas all in the emergency management world, the state does not have automatic jurisdiction over the locality, they can typically apply some influence. And so if your local emergency manager was just very standoffish and you could find out which person covered your region at the state level, it's likely that person is going to be a little more receptive to help. And they also may be able to reach back down to the locality and maybe in a strategic and tactful way ask if they can help the emergency manager connect up with you. So that would be my answer to that.
So, can I ask one more question?
Sure.
Yeah. So every year we send out a letter to the local emergency, for say hospital, nursing home. So when we contact them, and basically what we want to do is just let them know we are exiting in the area. So if something happened, we can kind of getting some help from them. Is that what the purpose?
So you send a letter out?
Yeah, like every year we send a letter out to like the nursing home who the patient used to go to or the local hospital every year, just like a notification. So
yeah, and that's certainly not a bad thing to do. And you've got some documentation that you sent that out. I can say, yeah, keep in mind that if a letter arrives at your facility, you got day-to-day business going on. I used to be in healthcare. I used to see patients every day. Every time I would get a letter like that, I might look at it initially and think, man, is this from some vendor trying to get me to buy something? And I'm likely to just pitch it in the bin. And so, that's outreach at one level, joining the healthcare coalition, reaching out to the healthcare coalition, get in touch with the emergency manager, and maybe trying to, if you have the opportunity, actually meet the emergency preparedness folks at the other facilities. Is sort of one step better, so to speak. And so sending out the notification and the letter, certainly not a bad thing. Not going to tell you to stop doing that, of course. But I would encourage the emergency manager and me, I would encourage you to put just a little bit more effort into that one and try to get a face-to-face with somebody, see if you can't form up a relationship. It'll go much further than that letter when the stuff hits the fan, so to speak.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Mike Girotti. Your line is open. Mike Girotti, your line is open.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm calling from Palm Desert, California. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Okay, great. We have annual county or area-wide earthquake preparedness drills. So from what I was hearing, it sounded like if we get involved with that and network with that group that's putting that on and do a physical exercise with staff or, as you were suggesting, volunteers participating in that drill, that would meet the criteria of an exercise.
Now, understand that's a great question. And if you wouldn't mind muting your line, because I'm hearing myself feedback on your line, I will go ahead and answer that question, though.
Okay.
So hit mute there if you don't mind. He asked a great question. So he said locally we have a drill that happens that's earthquake-based, and here's the deal. Participating in a drill is not completing a full-scale exercise. However, if you have a drill that's already pulling together the community and you can participate in the planning for that and you can actually conduct an exercise, so you may say, you know what, this year in conjunction with the local earthquake drill, we are going to perform a full-scale exercise of shelter in place at our facility. And you're going to want to let the local first responders know ahead of time. You're going to want to let the city know ahead of time. All the people that are at those planning meetings, you're going to let them know this is happening. And then when the drill goes down, instead of just taking cover like you might in the regular earthquake drill, you're going to actually stand up your incident management team, and you're going to undertake all the activities you would take in order to shelter in place due to an earthquake. Go through all the procedures. Make all the same phone calls. If you would typically dial 911, then dial 911. Tell them it's a drill and not an emergency, or an exercise, rather, and not an emergency. But go through those processes. If you would typically have ambulances show up to start moving people, have them show up. Coordinate that with them ahead of time. So that is a multidisciplinary, multi-agency, multi-jurisdictional event. And I can't speak officially whether or not that meets the standard, but boy, oh boy, as far as I'm concerned, that's in the spirit of a comprehensive and substantial emergency management plan, and it meets the FEMA definition of full-scale exercise as far as I'm concerned. So I think you'd be 99%, if not 100% of the way there. Again, not by participating in a drill, but by piggybacking an actual full-scale exercise along with a drill that's already happening.
Thank you.
There are no further questions at this time.
Wonderful. Thank
we have one.
You. Go ahead, Craig.
We have one question on the chat. If you give me 2 seconds to read it, if it's a quick answer, maybe we can knock that one out. I want to make sure everybody gets what they came for. With a full-scale exercise, is there an exception for local EM to actively participate in the full-scale exercise of the facilities? And I lost the rest of the chat box. A full-scale exercise does not define exactly how many that you need. It doesn't, and you can't mandate their participation. And that leads me to the last piece of the exercise requirement, and that is that CMS has a section in there that says, if it is truly impossible for you to conduct a community-based full-scale exercise, then you can conduct a facility-based full-scale exercise and meet the standard. And back to the spirit of the rule and the emergency manager in me, I cannot encourage you enough to do everything you can do to get that outreach from those people and to plan in conjunction with other facilities, other organizations, other jurisdictions, with law enforcement and first response and fire, et cetera, et cetera. But the rule does state that truly if you cannot do that, and that is impossible, and you can document that you did the outreach and it failed, then the rule does provide for you the ability to do a facility-based exercise, a full-scale exercise, that doesn't reach outside the facility. But I truly can't express enough the value in a response to you having already set up those relationships. Let's think of an active shooter rolling into your facility. And, you know, when the police officers get there, they're going – everybody else is running away from the gunfire, and they're running toward it. And so if they don't even know what the inside of your facility looks like, think about the disadvantage that puts them in when their lives are on the line. So I can't stress enough how important it is to do everything you can do to have that multi-agency, multi-jurisdictional actual response, involvement in planning and whatnot. Now, all that said, the rule does provide that if that's impossible, truly impossible – that you can get away with a functional exercise if you've documented that you, or with a, I'm sorry, with a facility-based exercise, if you've documented you tried to get the higher standards. So I think that's it, Nicolette. Sorry for running over time with those questions, but I think all the questions we answered were probably questions everybody had. So I think it was valuable.
Absolutely. Thanks, Craig. We don't see any other questions on our end. Operator, one last check. Are there any questions on the line?
There are no audio questions.
Fantastic. So thank you so much for participating. We will have all of our slides as well as just some additional slides that give you some more detail about our organizations and some other references that would be of use to you on our website. But feel free to call in any of us if you do have any questions. Our contact information is on the screen. Feel free to email us or just use our websites as additional resources to find out more information about the rule and also how we can be assistance to you as you begin to comply. Thank you so much for participating and have a good afternoon.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.